Welcome, everybody. Lunchtime at LSC, and we have an exciting lunchtime event. My name is Sam Fankhauser. I'm director of the Grantham Research Institute here at the LSC. But you're here for my guest, the Honourable Catherine McKenna, Minister of Environment and Climate Change in Canada. Catherine McKenna has been elected to Parliament not that long ago, in October 2015, and then it took her less than a month to become a minister. She became a minister under the Trudeau, the Liberal government, in November 2015, and was dispatched to Paris, I think, within days of taking office. So it's quite an amazing career progression. My theory is it has something to do with your education. Because Catherine holds a master's degree in international relations from LSE. She's also studied law at McGill University, and she was an undergraduate at the University of Toronto. And I think law is what you did before you took on your current role. You're a member of the Law Society of Upper Canada at the New York Bar. My notes say that you practice competition law and international trade law. Wikipedia tells me that you trained in human rights law and social justice, so you will have to clarify which one, probably both of those that you did. Certainly, you have an interest in human rights and social justice. One of the things Catherine has done was she was a senior negotiator for the UN peacekeeping mission in East Timor. So quite an amazing, really amazing CV, career, the best, no doubt, still to come. But why don't we start off with the students here in the room, many of whom will be sitting there and thinking, wow, how can I make a career like that? How can I make a difference? What would you tell them?
Chill out. No. I actually kind of mean that. In that, I know a lot of students here, you're probably feeling a lot of pressure. And maybe you're even saying, like, wow, I'd really like to have a career like that. I did the same thing. I'm not going to tell you how long ago, but it was a long time ago. Life, there's serendipity in life. There's hard work in life. And there's a little bit of, you know, who you know, making connections. And I think those all kind of work together. And then most of all, there's your passion. Right, and that's actually the most important thing. You have to not have people drill it out of you. I was in corporate law, so it almost got drilled out of me for a bit, but actually useful now because I often have to go to negotiations. When I look at my career, it only makes sense in retrospect. Like, you can go and create a narrative about everything you did, and it sounds really like a nice, tidy package. But that's not how life works, right? Like, you know, you have a partner. So I ended up working in Indonesia. My husband also graduated the London School of Economics. He tells me his program was harder. He was in international history. I tell him mine was more fun. I don't know. We ended up in Jakarta, which was really interesting. Started my career in Jakarta. Like, what a strange place to start a career. This is when Suharto fell. So students were demonstrating on the streets, and East Timor voted for independence. And I said, like, let's go to East Timor and work for the UN. So I was able to do that. Certainly my background and passion was really really human rights, social justice, but you have to pay the bills, like your LSE bills sometimes. So it's good, you know, I got some experience in the corporate world. And then after that, came back to Canada, did international trade and competition law, but also started a charity called Canadian Lawyers Abroad, now Level Justice. And I did different things after that, or at the same time, I taught. But, I mean, I think the most important thing to remember is that you're not going to figure it all today. You're not going to get the job you want as soon as you graduate, unless you're really lucky. But if you work really hard, if you're always kind of looking at what are you passionate about and pursuing that, either on a voluntary basis or ideally a paid basis, you'll eventually get there. And certainly having you know, a degree from the London School of Economics really helped. Like, people knew, like, when I went to Jakarta, and it was the height of the economic crisis. I didn't have a bar yet, so I didn't know if I'd pass the New York bar. But people look at, you know, and they're like, wow, you went to the London School of Economics. I mean, that's, you know, showing that, you know, that you did well in school to get here, that you kind of have an understanding of the world. And that matters. But The chill out part is a bit the chill out part because you can't force everything and it's not all going to happen at once. But and the last thing is really the passion. Keep your passion. It's easy to get discouraged. Life is going to throw curveballs. You might have a parent who gets sick and you have to go care for them, or you have a partner that takes you off to Jakarta or whatever it is. But you can end up in the right spot. And I obviously am so thrilled that I'm in this position now, but how could I have known? Like, certainly in politics, you can't really know, because politics timing is really everything. And I feel really fortunate, though, that I'm in this really awesome job now.
Just to make clear, we didn't pay you for the LSE plug that just came. But let's sort of talk about your current job. And there was sort of a tangible change in tone and substance on environmental policy when you took office. An amazing sort of piece of political leadership. How did you do that?
We believe climate change is real, so that was a good change. And we could say climate change. And we could not unmuzzle our scientists, so those are all obviously really important pieces. I mean, I say that in jest, but I don't. I think you can get very discouraged by what you're seeing in the U.S. at the federal level. But the good news is, in Canada, actually, there was a lot of action on climate change by provinces and through their leadership. Part of the reason I ran is because I thought we needed a change. I have three kids. It wasn't necessarily, you don't know how things are going to go in politics. I didn't know if I'd win. I was in Ottawa Centre. I had to knock on a lot of doors. We knocked on, to the hard work thing, more than 100,000 doors with my team. 2 years out, we started. But when we came in, we wanted to do things differently. The Prime Minister really believes that we owe it to the next generation, we owe it to you guys, to do things better, to make decisions based on science and evidence, to actually play a leadership role in the world, that Canada can punch above our weight. And the first thing, I mean, it was actually, the tone was set, because when I was asked by the Prime Minister, I was asked to be the first ever Minister of Environment and Climate Change. I almost fell off my seat, because my background, I care about the environment, but I wasn't an environmentalist. And then I was told that I was going off to Paris 2 days later. And actually, just to say, you should never, there are no dumb questions. So I thought about it for a bit, because everyone kept on talking about COP21. And so I finally said, okay, what's a COP? So that's where I started. Like, I didn't know it was Conference of the Parties. But in the end, we were able to play a really important role. And that actually set the stage. What was really great, and I have great public servants, actually, I think a number of them are here. I mean, I was trying to figure all of this out, but we took a totally different approach. We went with provinces and territories, we went with indigenous peoples, we went with young people, and we pushed a number of areas that were really important in the longer term on our agenda. So we pushed for recognition of indigenous peoples and indigenous rights, which was extraordinarily important, it was reflected. We really pushed on gender. Right now, we're leading to have that gender is reflected in the work program, the Paris work program, but also that we have women negotiators, so that we train women to be at the table. And so we were able to do a lot. I was able to be involved directly in the negotiations of the market tax. I really believe in the important role that markets play. And that set the stage for what we then had to do in Canada, which I know you're going to talk about, but we had to come back after years of a government doing nothing, and where your emissions go like this, bending the curve is really hard.
And how do you make it sustainable? How do you make it stick? When what happens when the other lot gets back in? Will they reverse everything you do?
Well, I'm going to knock on a lot of doors so they won't get back in. But you have to. That stickiness is important. And I think you can look at what happened in the United States, where I worked extremely closely with the Obama administration. They led on climate action. They pushed so hard. They were very instrumental in getting an ambitious Paris Agreement. But they're gone now. And I worry about that, right? Like, you can't be lurching. Businesses don't even like, they don't like it when you lurch. They need certainty about, if we're moving to a low carbon future, they want to see that. And so I think there are many ways that you have to tackle climate change. Regulation, clearly extremely important. Market signals, putting a price on pollution, carbon disclosure. There's, pieces like that. There's investments in innovation. But there's also bringing people on board. And so, inevitably, I know people are going to ask me about pipelines. I get a lot about pipelines in the oil sands. And we're in a transition, folks. Like, it's hard, things are hard. And I say this, but I actually really mean it. I'm the Minister of Environment and Climate Change for oil sands workers as much as I am for environmentalists. Like, people need jobs. And that doesn't mean the job is always going to be the same job. It's just that if you don't convince people that you have a plan, that you're being thoughtful, that they're part of it, that there is going to be a transition, but that you will still have a job. Most people are, I realize, when you knock on doors, they're trying to get food on the table. They're trying to get their kids to activities. And they care about the environment. And in Canada, it's great. People really care about the environment. But they're just trying to figure out what is the future. And bringing people on board is really important. It really is. It's mapping out. It's explaining. It's how you talk about things. Talking about putting a price on pollution, I think suddenly people understood. They're like, yeah, I hate pollution. So it became more acceptable that you would price what you don't want, pollution, so you get what you do want, lower emissions and innovation. But how you talk about it, how you engage people, listening to folks is I think, the ultimate in stickiness.
So we had Jeff Sachs here, as you know, about a week ago, and I look in the audience, some of the faces look familiar. They were here, and you remember what Jeff Sachs said. He said two things. First of all, that you're an amazing environment minister. Second, he said, ask her how long you will dig up tar sands. And it is sort of a legitimate question. We know 2/3 of all fossil fuels we know have to stay in the ground. Yours are a bit expensive, they're a bit dirty. Why don't you leave yours in the ground? How long will that take?
Well, I mean, so as I said, we're in a transition, right? We had a government that for 10 years did nothing. So you can't just say overnight, boom, we're closing the oil sands. You can't. I mean, in fact, it would have such a negative impact on the economy in Canada, a dislocating impact, that it would actually impact on our ability to do the things that we want to do to move to a low-carbon future. We're making historic investments in public transit and in green infrastructure. You know, you need to do things in a logical way. And so that's why we've been so focused on, you know, putting a price on pollution. We also have to work with provinces. And Alberta, it has a progressive government, the first ever government to do what is tough, to put a hard cap on emissions from the oil sands, to put a price on carbon pollution, and to phase out coal. And those are really important pieces. They're not everything. But, you know, the thing I would say to Jeff Sachs, we've had many conversations, is there's also the demand side. So there's still a lot of cars out there that are not electric vehicles, right? We still have inefficient houses. We still have, I mean, we need to move forward. And of course that we're moving to a cleaner future. And of course I would love to be as ambitious as possible. But people, we need to figure this out for people. We need to figure this out for government. We need to always ratchet it up. That's why the Paris Agreement is extremely good, because you have to ratchet up the ambition. We need to foster innovations, and those are the small innovations, and those are the game-changing innovations. Like, we have great innovators in Canada. One of the ones I talk about is Carbon Cure out of Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. Anyone here from Dartmouth? No, Nova Scotia? Canada? Oh, all right, we got
lots
all right,
of Canadians
Canada.
Around.
That's awesome. I love that there are Canadians here. Il y a des francophones? Oui, alors bonjour, francophones. Je peux vous parler en français après, ou avec vos questions. So Carbon Cure, actually, someone who was doing his master's thesis at McGill, he looked at how do you take pollution, carbon dioxide, out of industry and inject it to make stronger and cheaper cement. This was his master's thesis. Now, I was just in California a few months ago at a cement factory where I watched his new technology being used, and it reduces the carbon footprint by 20%. Like, we also need the innovation piece. So, you know, as I say, hard things are hard. We're working extraordinarily ambitiously, but we're also working, we have to work with provinces and territories. We're working with Indigenous peoples, and ultimately, we're working for and are responsible to Canadians.
You mentioned the provinces, and one of the eye-catching things that you've done recently is the Pan-Canadian Framework on Clean Growth.
That's tell a very us, un-eye-catching title, by the way. I call it the Made in Canada Climate Plan. But
call it what you want. Tell us what you want to achieve with it.
So after we came back from Paris, as I said, we had to do the hard work at home. And we spent a whole year working with provinces and territories, working with indigenous peoples, roundtables with industry, with Canadians, and really getting the input and doing the modeling. I mean, it's basically a modeling exercise. You have to figure out if you've got a target. So we have a 2030 target. You have to get your emissions to go down. And you have to figure out each sector by sector, how are you going to do that? And then you have to figure out what's politically possible. And those aren't always, they don't always match up. So it takes a lot of hard work. And so there are a number of pieces to it. So announcing that we would have a price on pollution across the country and that it would ratchet up, the price would go up. And if provinces didn't do that, we would impose, which was not what we want to do. We'd like provinces to step up. Phasing out coal, which requires supporting the provinces, the four provinces that are on coal. Looking at buildings, the built environment, clearly the emissions from the built environment are a big challenge. We need to be building better, so striving towards net zero buildings. I hope I see like a fancy new building. I hope it's net zero. I don't know. I'll see.
Check that.
Fingers crossed. You know, zero emission vehicle strategy. You have to do all of those pieces. And I was really proud when you had last year the Prime Minister standing with all of the premiers and with our national Indigenous organizations and saying, here it is. Here's our Canadian plan. And that, you can't just announce a plan. Like, of course you could. We could sit in our little room, you know, thinking, you know, we're really smart and we've come up with it. But you, once again, it gets to getting people on board and provinces, you know, have to support it. And, you know, there were disagreements. We don't always, you know, we don't always see eye to eye on things. But I think we got to a really good spot. And I'm very, you know, positive that we can continue doing more because Canadians believe in climate action. And I think as you see the future being mapped out, you see the changes. And also with the young people really pushing, I think we're in a good spot compared to other countries.
Talk a lot about climate change, but you're Minister of the Environment. What are your other environmental concerns and priorities?
So the good news is in life, maybe at LSE I learned this, you can only have three real priorities. Like you can have lots of priorities. So if you like listed everything I have to do, you can go see my mandate letter the first time ever our mandate letters were made public. So there's loads of things that I'm doing. I'm working with my officials and my political team. But the big thing I'm working on, two other big things I'm working on now, so continuing obviously to drive on climate action, but redoing environmental assessments. So this includes pipelines, it includes major projects, so mines, it could be major wind farms, and how we make sure that we have the trust of the public as we do assessments. And this is a major piece of legislation that it's been very divisive, certain projects in Canada. We haven't worked properly with Indigenous peoples, both in terms of our international commitments, UNDRIP, our constitutional obligations, but just also in terms of a true partnership. Reconciliation is extraordinarily important to our government. And making sure you have good science. And I think that I was tasked with rebuilding trust in environmental assessments, working with a few other ministers. And so that's really important because you have to figure that out and get it right. And it's the high-low. Like there's the big piece of rebuilding trust and reconciliation. And then there's like the nitty-gritty. And so if you are in law, it's not all doom and gloom because actually it serves me very well because I drive my team crazy because I'm like, well, what does this mean in practical terms? Like if I'm an investor or if I'm a member of the public who wants to feed into it, how exactly is this going to look? So that's a big piece. And then I'm also the minister responsible for parks. As I say, that's my happy place. I love, if you follow me on social media, I love my favorite thing is either being out in the water swimming or in a kayak or a canoe, and increasing the percentage of areas that we, either marine or terrestrial areas that we protect, either as a park or other protection areas, is extraordinarily important. We have UN targets that are ambitious. So 10% of our ocean, 17% of our terrestrial area, our land, to be protected. It's so important. With climate change, that making sure that you have carbon sinks, that you're really thinking about the oceans and the role the oceans play is really important. Adapting to climate change, having these areas that will be really important in adaptation. We have a huge problem with species at risk in Canada. We've seen the decline in different species, and so connected spaces are really important. So this is it's a really exciting piece. Once again, working very closely with the provinces and territories. I was in the high Arctic. Who's been in the Arctic? Anyone been in the Arctic? I wish everyone would come to the Arctic. It's really stunning, and it's also really remarkable, the Inuit, the relationship with Inuit and the land, the ice, the animals. And I was really excited because I was going through a place called Taliurutyup, Amanga, as they say in Inuktitut, and we were able to declare it a marine conservation area, 2% of our oceans. It's the gateway to the Northwest Passage, an extraordinarily important part of our ecosystem, but very important to Inuit. And that's like those are the things where I realized, like, I feel like those are real legacy pieces. Like, you know, hopefully no one can ever do seismic testing in those areas, that you aren't going to go develop those areas. And that's just really, those are the things where I'm like, wow, you in this job, so aspiring politicians, you actually can make a real difference if you go into politics.
I can confirm that your parks are wonderful, but let's talk a bit more beyond Canada, a bit more global. And I guess the international world starts to your south, where just when Canada got going on the environment, the U.S. started slowing down.
Let's just be clear. It's not the U.S. It's the U.S. administration.
Okay. How do you, in that case, how do you preserve the momentum in the U.S.? Is it working with cities and states, or is there other things that you that we can do?
So many ways to answer this question. No, look, so, I mean, there's the federal government. They've announced their intention to withdraw from the Paris Agreement. To be clear, they cannot actually announce their intention to withdraw until 2019, and then in 2020 it wouldn't take effect until 2020. So we certainly made the case that we think this is a terrible idea, and that we really hope there's a way that the U.S. can stay in. But we just hosted a ministerial meeting. Canada, for the first time, really stepped up. We co-hosted with China and the European Union a meeting of major economies, which used to be actually the U.S. would host these in advance of COPs. And everyone there said the Paris Agreement is non-negotiable and irreversible. So that is the message that the world has given. But, you know, there are many parts of the United States. There's the federal administration, there are states, there are cities, and their businesses. And it's interesting what happened. I mean, there was a bit of a reality TV show, was the U.S. in or out of the Paris Agreement. Most people didn't even know what the Paris Agreement was. So suddenly the heightened understanding of the Paris Agreement, I think, was a good thing. And then when the U.S. announced this decision, people and businesses and governors and mayors, they were louder than ever about their support for the Paris Agreement, and that they were going to actually take, you know, accelerate their own action. I mean, can you imagine a situation where you have the CEO of Goldman Sachs, first tweet to the world, is expressing disappointment with the decision to withdraw from Paris? So there's been a shift, and I think it demonstrates the shift. It demonstrates how important the Paris Agreement was to the markets, to business, and that how important it is to people. That's why cities, mayors are stepping up, and governors, because it's really important. So we're working very closely with all the other players. I've said I will work with anyone who wants to take serious action on climate change. Governor Jerry Brown in California, they're actually not just a state, they're the sixth largest economy in the world. He's amazing, and we're working very closely with California. I spent a lot of time with Michael Bloomberg. He's been really pushing to get recognition of subnationals and businesses in the context of the Paris Agreement. So bringing U.S., all of, you know, what does it represent, all the emissions reductions that are controlled by these folks? So across the board, you're seeing this, and you're seeing this action. And, I mean, you just look at the stats, science, evidence-based, that's our focus, that you have jobs in renewables. They're growing more than 10 times that of other jobs in the U.S. economy. The number of jobs in solar and wind, I think, is like maybe 485,000, give or take a few. In the U.S., the number of jobs from coal, 166,000, and it's declining. And coal's not coming back, right? Like, it's just not. That's a market thing. And natural gas is just cheaper. And so I think that you're going to continue to see changes. Michael Bloomberg's very optimistic. He thinks that the U.S. Will reach its target, even without the Clean Power Plan. And we're just going to keep on working really hard with the people that want to work on this, because a lot of, I think people forget this, that everyone's always like the federal government, because I get this like all the time, well, you need to do more. Well, actually 40% of emissions are under control of cities, depending on how you look at it. And so there are other really important players and businesses. And this is everyone from Pepsi Cola to Mars to Anheuser-Busch to obviously Silicon Valley companies. So there's a lot of action going on in the U.S.
So Michael Bloomberg is optimistic. Are you optimistic? Can we still do 1.5 degrees?
1.5 degrees is going to be very hard. We're only, I think, at 3.7 degrees if every country does what they've said. So that's the U.S. even meeting its target. So we need to do more. We all know this. We need to be more ambitious. And that, as I said, the Paris Agreement allows for that. It requires that you increase your ambition. And I'm a realistic optimist in life. I mean, I guess in politics you don't have a choice, but it's just my nature that you just have to work really hard and you have to bring people on side, but you also have to innovate. And like, there's huge innovations. And they're really important pieces. So I was with Mark Carney, our greatest export to the UK, and just for all of you from the UK, we're taking him back someday. He's talking about carbon disclosure. I think that's really important. If you disclose the risk, that the market will adapt, and the trillions of dollars that are the opportunity, the trillion dollars will flow in the direction that we need. But we're going to need to work hard. And we're going to need to support developing countries and help them figure out the path forward. We're going to have to continue to push. And in Canada, of course, we're going to have to continue to be ambitious.
How do you support developing countries in Canada? What's your program, your level of ambition?
So we announced a historic investment support for developing countries, $2.65 billion when we went to Paris. And that's to help countries both mitigate their emissions, but also very importantly adapt to the impacts of climate change. And we've just seen, I mean, how challenging it is for many countries that you see with extreme weather events like hurricanes, like droughts, like floods that are happening all over the world. The climate's already changing. I talked about the Canada's north. It's warming three times that of the rest of Canada. So we need to focus on doing that. We do that through the Green Climate Fund. We do that through multilateral funds. And I'm also a practical person, so I think we need to really help governments make good decisions, like make the decision to, instead of opening the new coal-fired plant, go to renewables. And so looking at, that's a financing piece that we can help out with. So we're absolutely committed. And this was in the Paris Agreement. It's really difficult negotiations on many fronts, but making sure that the developed countries supported developing countries, we wouldn't have had an ambitious Paris Agreement without that. And so that's something we're absolutely committed to. I think we need to get the private sector more part of this conversation too, so we can have the trillions, not the hundreds, the 100 million, billions and trillions that are needed.
Very good. Let's open it up. All those Canadians in the room and all those international people in the room, your chance for questions. Usual sort of rules. Question means a short statement with a question mark at the end, not an essay. And please introduce yourself. They're roaming microphones, and I have a choice. Actually, why don't you have a choice? You pick your own question.
I don't know. Is that someone from Nova Scotia? Yep. I don't know. It's around that direction. I don't know. Blonde hair up there? Yeah.
Let's start at the top. And let's collect
my
maybe
name is
Harold
Yerklin. I'm doing a master's in environmental policy here. And
where are you from?
I'm from Norway.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I actually worked on a farm in Montreal, and it was a small organic farm. And basically, a huge problem in Canada is that the median age of farmers is like 60 years old, and monocropping culture is massive. So I was just wondering if there was any initiative towards sustainable agriculture as a policy implemented for this.
Okay, question about sustainable agriculture. Where do you want to go next?
Oh, I don't know. You know what? Okay, I'm going to let
actually,
you have
there's
the
a lady there in the middle, as far away from the microphone as you can possibly sit. But let's see whether we can get that to you.
Hi, thanks for the speech. It was really interesting. My name's Vibeka. I'm a reporter and I write about environmental finance. And you talked about the need of getting the private sector to shift the trillions. And in Europe at the moment, the European Commission has a high-level expert group looking at sustainable finance to try and get policy to support that. And I understand in Canada there's a similar initiative might be happening. Are you familiar with it? And have you been in talks with people in Canada about it?
Okay, thank finance you. Initiative. Let's just go one row forward, gentleman in the red shirt. Then we come to you guys in the back in the next round.
Hi, my name is Daniel Witte. I'm at the MSc Global Politics here and actually did my exchange at McGill, minoring in environment, when the government of Trudeau was went to power. So it's interesting to hear about the government's initiatives. My question is about the regional city approaches to climate change and the national approaches, which you talked about a lot. The Paris Agreement is seen as a more bottom-up agreement, whereas the Kyoto Protocol was more top-down. Of course, we need both actors involved. How do you see that? What's the role of the state now, and what will be the optimal way to balance this out?
Okay, let's do those three, and then
great. Very good question. So I'll just start with that one, and then I'll go in reverse order. So you're absolutely right. We need regional and national approaches. I mean, the federal government, we're a federation, so it depends on you know what your structure is. But in Canada, the federal government, I mean, we set the policy framework, some of the really big pieces like pricing. We fund initiatives, so infrastructure is a huge piece. So I'm from Ottawa, and we just invested in light rail transit in Ottawa. It will be the largest reduction in greenhouse gas emissions in the city's history. I think that you can't be too prescriptive when you're up here. So you want there to be, getting back to the organic body, you want things to be a bit organic about how things, you know, what cities want to do. But I'm just about the bottom line. I'm about emissions reductions. So I think when you put money out the door, whether you're making historic investments in social housing, which we are doing, that in particular for people who have the least amount of money, you need to make sure it's energy efficient and you just drive that because you make incentives to ensure that you get to that spot. I mean, the great thing in Canada is you have cities like Vancouver who are, I think, probably the greenest city, one of the greenest cities in the planet, and they actually look at that as one of their, when they look at the value of their brand, it's based on being green and clean. And they've done some really innovative things, and so you also want to see, you want to test things, and then you want to, you know, get other cities and, you know, to replicate them. So I think that creating incentives to do that, we do that with the Federation of Canadian Municipalities. We have funding there. I also like competitions. I think competitions are good. So come up with your best ideas. And as I say, I do want to see your emissions reduction. That's like, it's the name of the game now. How much are you going to reduce your emissions? But it's not always that obvious because sometimes incentives to change behavior, you have to do the nudge and then you can get the bigger changes. So I think you have to be smart about that. But certainly, you know, we need to be doing both and we need to be supporting cities that are going in the right direction. And it's carrots and sticks to that. On the sustainable finance, I mean, this is really key. And I just did this roundtable last night, so I said with Governor Carney, but I had all sorts of different players there, like everything from BlackRock to major insurance companies to HSBC to, I mean, a whole bunch of players. And it's actually really interesting when you do that because you actually realize, like, they all realize that climate change is real and they need, you know, we need to be doing more. But it's always this question of what tools you use, what incentives you have. And I think the most important thing is how do you mainstream it? So you don't want it to just be like funds, small funds, like you want it to be across the board. And that's harder. I really do think what the task force did on climate disclosure is really, really important. I think that pricing, we talked a lot about that, putting a price, setting the signal, having stickiness, so knowing, I mean, business just wants to know what's like, they'll figure it out. If you say this is the framework, they will figure out how to get there, except if they think it might change. Interestingly, in the U.S., you haven't actually seen businesses like overwhelmingly say, this is great that you're removing all these regulations, because you adapt as a business. You build that into your business model and planning. I mean, one thing that they have here in the U.S. is there's the task force on green finance with Sir Roger and others through Treasury. And I think that's really important. I think we're going to do that, that I think we need to probably think pretty hard about what will drive this trillions to, you know, in really mainstream ways in the direction we need. Sustainable agriculture. I wish I had our Minister of Agriculture. He's a farmer from Prince Edward Island. Sustainable agriculture is key. And there's this, oh, right, so you're up there in the wrong spot. There's the small scale, like, you know, the organic farms in cities, and then there's kind of, we have larger farms in Canada. And you've seen a real change that you now see, you know, a real focus on climate resilient crops, on zero till agriculture. The use of big data and drones means that you can be way smarter about how much fertilizer you use, how much water you use. So I think that there's a huge piece there. And agriculture is also methane from cows, a big piece of emissions. So we need to figure that out. And I think you're right about, like, what more can we be doing? You know, Canada is every country is different in their in terms of their approach to farming. We're also an extremely big country, but I think that, you know, focusing on how do we in cities, you know, have the ability to have, you know, local little farms that people play into. In Ottawa Centre, we actually have we have an experimental farm in the middle of the city, and we're talking about what more we could do with the food bank to have people grow food there. It's also just a good thing. People know where their food comes from. That's, most people are very disconnected from that. But then the larger scale things, because the larger scale is actually the game changers on this. So really driving zero-till agriculture and the use of new technologies.
Okay, very good. We have time for another round, and we have...
We could do a speed round. I could be super speedy.
Can you?
There's, like, a lot of questions.
Let's see whether we can do that. Let's. Okay, very quick questions. Let's start there with the gentleman right at the end. And
Marcus, I'm a legal researcher dividing my time between Canada and the UK.
Oh, yes, hello.
Hey, Catherine. I had a quick question. I like the sort of global level. The EU is introducing or expanding the ETS to shipping. And Canada has been hugely instrumental in bringing Corsair about in the ICAO. Do you expect that your ministry and Transport Canada will play a similar role in IMO?
Yes. See, that's how fast I can be.
Okay.
Yes, shipping is a key part of this for a variety of reasons: black carbon, short-lived climate pollutants, but also the bigger piece. So yes, we are definitely going to be involved. And I've said as ambitious as we can be, and we're tough negotiators. So.
Okay. See whether you can keep up that speed. I'm slower in choosing the questions than you are in answering them. It's a lady sort of halfway in the middle row.
Me.
You, yes, please.
Hi. I'm just an A-level student, so I'm probably the youngest here. So
you're not just. That's good. It's International Day of the Girl too.
Okay. My question was, you mentioned how these poorer countries and countries all over the world are really affected by climate change. What do you think about, as Canada, as a country, giving benefits to these poorer countries who do release less, you know, carbon emissions and have less of an impact? What kind of benefits do you think rich countries should be offering them?
So, I mean, I think we have to be supporting less developed countries. I mean, I think we have a moral obligation to do that. And also, you know, they need support. They don't have the money. And so, I mean, that's what I was talking about, the support, the $2.65 billion that Canada has. But beyond that, there's also the private sector funding, because we often get in this, you know, how much can governments give? There is a limit. I mean, I think government should give more, but we need trillions of dollars. So really bringing in the private sector as well. It's not going to work in every project, but some projects, there are opportunities. But countries really need help. You look at Barbuda, it was totally destroyed. You can go look in the Horn of Africa, some of the impacts of droughts. And we're just going to see this, it's going to increase. So we need to be supporting them. We also need to reduce our emissions, because we have to stop the warming.
Let's change corner. Let's go right front row there.
Hello, ma'am. It was a very interesting speech. My name is Dave. I'm from India. Most of the developing economies seem to be investing in solar power. And these solar panels, which are manufactured, take, you know, the electricity generated from the coal and the gas plants. And the same electric panels take 20 years to generate the electricity that is, you know, put into, you know, develop these panels. I mean, did I make myself clear? If these are the kind of initiatives that the government is funding, and don't you think it doesn't make sense? Because, you know, you're using today's coal and gas power to manufacture a panel which is going to take 20 years to generate the same amount of current.
So if you're saying, does it make sense that we move to renewables? Yes. Does it make sense that we get off coal-fired plants? Yes. Will it take a mix in your electricity sector? Yes. If you look at India, I mean, India is moving really fast when it comes to renewables. And I think there's things have changed. The cost has gone down. So that's a huge driver. Now you have Chile. I think it's a lot cheaper to use solar than it is to use other sources. But there's also the cost if you look at the life cycle cost and the cost to the environment. So we just need to make smarter choices. And, that means we're going to have to look at renewables. There's a whole energy mix, but we don't really have a choice. I mean, what's the alternative? The alternatives will just stay on coal because we're still using coal. I think the alternative is we move as fast to clean up the electricity sector. I think that's key. And then we electrify everything, and we're doing it with renewables ultimately.
There's an insistent hand right at the back. Let's go there.
Thank you. When I was studying engineering, I spent a lot of time in Toronto. And
I'm originally from the Hammer, Hamilton, so we have like a rivalry, but it's okay. I went to U of T, so Toronto's all right.
Thank you. I've asked these questions on Twitter, and I'd first ask that you continue to engage the conversation on Twitter, but the most important thing to say is that the only reason you would assert that reassigning fossil fuel workers to renewables and power to gas synthetic carbon neutral fuel would hurt the economy instead of help is because the producers of synthetic fuel price, such as Google Project Foghorn, for example, prices at $15 per gallon, which is based on retail electricity. If you take off-peak wind power, there's no demand at night. It's 3%. That's 55 cents per gallon. And will you please join the effort to correct that very serious mistake?
So just to understand, I mean, if you're saying that we need to transition faster, I agree. But transitions don't, like, you can't just say tomorrow, like, shut down oil sands and everyone's going to have jobs. It doesn't work like that. It is a transition. And look, we're working very closely with the Alberta government. They are part of the solution. They really care about this. But we have to do things in a smart way. It gets back to the whole thing that it's not going to help you if you get a government that's elected, potentially in Alberta, that doesn't believe in climate action.
Actually, you mentioned Twitter, so let me interject the Twitter question.
What's going
we
on
have
on
a handful
Twitter?
Of those.
Let's go check it out.
You can check your Twitter while I read out the question. It's from an architect in Ottawa, and slightly predictably,
we got some like a good Ottawa connection here.
They ask the predictable question about the role of architecture in tackling climate change.
There's no role. Imagine I said that, he'd be like so upset. I know who it is. It's a friend of mine. Look, architecture is part. You're just going to keep on pushing me, no matter where I am around the world. Look, architecture is of course part of it. Like I ask, is this a net zero building or a building that produces energy? Because I actually really care. Like we can build better. And we can build smarter, and we can use smart grids, but we're not doing it. Like, for the love of God, what is wrong with us? Like, sometimes I just shake my head. So, yes, absolutely. How we build, what materials we use, where we source these materials, how we build our cities, there is so much more we can do. We just have to be smarter about it. So I don't know. All I can say is, I mean, government has a role to play, but everyone should be saying, like, why when you go and, you have your house, you get someone to renovate, you should say, like, how do I make this house as energy efficient as possible? That for new builds, we should be at least, like, passive standard, where you aren't using energy, or active, that you're actually producing energy. We can do this. And as I say in Canada, When you do this, you actually create jobs because, you know, you create a virtuous cycle where people renovate, they source the materials locally because people build, they develop the materials, and then, you know, it just continues going on. So I think that there's a huge opportunity there. I'm trying to drive it at the federal government level, but it's also at the provincial level, it's at the city level, and you guys are all consumers, so you are all part of this.
Very good. Let's ask a question you haven't heard before.
I have to get faster. Okay, maybe faster.
No, the speed is actually impressive, but we're not running out. There's a hand up there in the middle.
Hi there. It's good to see you again, Minister McKenna. My name's Erin Roberts. I'm originally from Vancouver, but I came here to do my Master's in Development Studies a few years ago and stayed to do my PhD at King's. I'm also an advisor to the African Group of Negotiators. My question is about enhancing ambition. Mm-hmm. So you talked about the ratcheting up mechanism in the agreement. Can you talk about how Canada plans to enhance their NDC and the role of leadership in that process? Thank you.
So of course we need to ratchet up ambition. I mean, we did just get our climate plan, so I mean, we need to implement it too. And we need to work with provinces. So to imagine that the federal government can drive all the change on our own, we can't. But there's a lot of things we can be doing in addition to regulation. Because I think everyone's always like, go regulate. Like, just if you just regulated, you just did more, you just raised your carbon price right away, you just shut down the oil sands, we would solve all the problems. Well, life doesn't really work like that. And there are other tools. So we're looking at our infrastructure bank. How do we fund the really big things, like getting interties between provinces? So if you're on coal, you can get off coal easier, that you're working with provinces that have renewables. How do you fund, as I said, light rail transit? That's huge pieces. How do you fund transit so we have those returns? We're looking at big buildings. How do you retrofit buildings? Right now, there's not the incentives in place. If you own a building and you only hold it for 5 years, which often what happens, you don't get the return on your investment. There's a life cycle thing. So I think it's all hands on deck. Always looking for ideas and always looking at, you know, how do we create the right incentives? Because at the end, I think it's not what exact piece you're doing. It's how do all these incentives work together? And of course, province is a huge part of this because they have to be part of the decisions that we implement.
Very good. Right at the back is a hand in the middle.
It's good. I like it. Lots of questions.
Yeah,
we'll get through all of them.
I'm learning something about
speed Q&A. My name is Chen Han. I'm from Singapore doing economics here. My question is this: in 2013, the Labour government in Australia was kicked out because part of it was the imposition of a carbon tax. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask, is a carbon tax, in your opinion, more feasible at a federal level or state level? And how would you convince people, in particular those that live in regional and rural areas, that actually, you know what, this is a carbon taxation, putting a price on carbon is a good policy idea, because not many of them seem to be able to grasp it.
So there's a lot of ways to answer that. I mean, you need to show leadership, so it is important whatever level you are, you're going to have to be a bit courageous, because you're going to have people who are going to say, you know, things like job-killing carbon tax, ridiculous things. So you have to, you know, go out there and say this is the right thing to do and we're going forward with it. How you talk about it, I've always said, is good. You said price on pollution, because I think then people understand. But also you have to look at the, you know, how it will impact on real people. The last thing I want to do is have people who can barely pay the bills pay a lot more, you know, say in the north, where they don't even have alternatives. And so I think you have to be very thoughtful about price, about how you put a price on pollution. As I say, the good news in Canada is that we had courageous leadership at the provincial level. That was really important, that they really stepped up a number of provinces. So that meant that people were familiar with it, because people do get scared, and then you have people who don't even believe in climate change. Apparently there was one of them from Australia here a couple of days ago. You can go look at my Twitter feed. I have some serious comments about that. But, you have to bring people on board, because actually pricing pollution is one of those things that people, You know, you have to, they have to believe in it, otherwise it can be very, very politically challenging. But I think we're working really hard in Canada, and the system we've designed so that if you don't have a price is smart. That it's not going to drive emissions out, so that if you're a business, you know, instead of using a Canadian, going to, you know, a Canadian company, you're going to go to someone else. You have to design it in a way that makes sense, that has the impact that you want it to have. And I think that if you do that, if you communicate with people well, if you bring people on board, and if you're a bit courageous, I think you'll be okay.
Okay, let's sort of go upstairs again. Question in the front row up there on the balcony.
Minister, thank you very much for your time and the speech, which was fascinating. I'm Naz, and I'm at Systemic. My question is around the rights of Indigenous people that you spoke about tangentially in your talk. Of course, they're disproportionately affected by climate change, environmental changes. What steps can the federal government take, and what practical measures can you take to ensure, firstly, that rights are protected, but also in the 21st century, that the Indigenous people will continue to or further benefit from, you know, fostering clean growth and the benefits of the economies in the future? Thank you.
So, I mean, the number one lesson I've learned is you have to work with Indigenous peoples. Like, they have to be there talking to you about what solutions they want and what they expect. We've been working really hard in Canada with Indigenous peoples. In fact, when I go back, there's a working group on our climate change plan and how we should implement it. Pieces like, they want to be part of the solution. So getting off diesel, they want to make sure that, you know, in the rural and remote communities, that they also get jobs out of this, right? That if they get off diesel, they get jobs. It's not just a nice thing that we can say they're off diesel. You know, that jobs are an important piece. The broader question that you have, though, is it's a really important question. So we've committed to implement the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and we really are committed to reconciliation. And it's hard. Like, we're still all trying to figure this out together. You know, we have also Indigenous peoples. Also, you kind of throw that together like it's a holistic group. We have Inuit, we have Métis, we have First Nations, and First Nations is over 600 communities. So every community is different, and you just have to work really hard. And so we're trying to do that. I think internationally it's been really important to push the envelope. I think a lot of countries don't recognize the rights of Indigenous peoples, but even in Canada, we have a long way to go. And as you say, they're disproportionately impacted. They're often the poorest people in Canada, and they, you know, are wondering, like, what are we doing? And I saw that when I went to the Arctic. It was really striking. And figuring that out. So as they say to me, it's not just that you're going to save us, like, that's so paternalistic, but also how are we part of the solution? We have solutions to offer. So how do you properly use Indigenous traditional knowledge? So it's something we're working on. It is really hard. I'm lucky that I have, like, great friends and great, you know, Inuit, Métis, and First Nations people that help us try to figure out our way forward. But I think Canada can be a model on this. We have Minister of Justice and Attorney General. She's Indigenous. And she is driving this. We have new principles to implement across the board. So it's hard, but I think we're going to get to a much better spot. But, you know, for 150 plus years, the history of colonialism has been pretty brutal in Canada. And so fixing that and getting out in a better place is going to take some time. And that was a long answer, but that's an important question.
Somebody gets the last question, and it has to be a really brilliant one. Let's go there in the middle in the front row. You look like you had
a really brilliant question.
Pressure is on. Just need a microphone.
Hi, I'm Tina Marchand. I'm a Canadian living and working in London. I work on climate diplomacy at a think tank called E3G. And we really wanted to know if you could talk to us a bit more about the UK-Canada leadership or new alliance on phasing out coal, mm-hmm. and if you have some target countries in mind, people that you know, as Canadians, we're looking to influence at COP. Could be the Commonwealth, could be India, for example, is a major kind of coal.
I feel like this is like a setup because I'm doing an announcement with Claire Perry later. Oh, but
thank you.
So stay tuned. Look, phasing out coal is really important. UK has done a really great job. Canada, we've also announced that we're phasing out coal. But I think that's really where we should, if you want to just be practical, get coal out of the electricity mix. And so the World Bank, we're working closely with the World Bank to look at what countries we could help make the decision to use renewables as opposed to coal. I think, you know, obviously countries that have the large emitters like China, like India, are really important part of this. But China is working really, really hard in this front. So I think that is where we should all brainstorm. And we should just figure it out and just help. As I say, it's often just a financing thing. That countries would say, like, we would go to renewables, it's just too expensive. So let's just figure out how we can do that. So happy to talk to you guys later.
Very good. It's just one more thing to do before you all disappear to your next lecture, and that's just to thank Catherine McKenna very, very much. This has been an amazing hour. We covered a hell of a lot of ground, and
that's
you had
great.
The answers to everything. Really, really impressive.
I don't know about that.
Thank you very much.
But you know what? I just want to thank you guys. You know what? It is really, really special to be back here at LSE. I have really fond memories of my time here. And you know what? It's just an amazing time. So enjoy your experience here. Go to all these lectures. You get all sorts of people who come in. And then go do great things.
Thank you. And that was great advice.